The Tom Woods Show, episode 1003.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, everybody always thinks the current U.S. president must be the worst, but man, is there competition for that title. Check out our free course on the presidents and their crimes against liberty at freehistorycourse.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Today is a very exciting day for our guest Brian McClanahan. It is the official day of release for his brand new book, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. It includes a foreword by Ron Paul, and it is all around a fantastic book. You're going to learn a lot from it. So I urge you to check it out. Support Brian. He's a great guy, extremely hard worker, the author of numerous other books, including two entries in the Politically Incorrect Guide series, as well as The Founding Fathers Guide to the Constitution. He's also the host of The Brian McClanahan Show, which has more than 100 episodes now. So there's another podcast for you, The Brian McClanahan Show. I urge you to check out Brian. BrianMcClanahan.com is his website, but remember, his name is spelled B-R-I-O-N. BrianMcClanahan.com. I'll link to all this stuff, including the book, at TomWoods.com/1003. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thrilling that your book is available as of today. So, I mean, I don't even know if people are still listening. They're all busy going and buying it. I hope they can do two things at once.
That's right. I hope so. Yeah.
I can't imagine they would just be listening and not also buying. That blows my mind completely. We talked about Hamilton, you and I, in an episode earlier this year that I will link to on the show notes page. So let's revisit that conversation and move the discussion a little bit farther ahead. And to do that, we're going to be talking a lot about the courts, because the courts wound up taking Hamilton's ideas and basically foisting them on the country in ways that have become permanent. I mean, you know, if Hamilton favored a tariff or some immediate policy, most of those have come and gone by now, but the ideas have really become ossified thanks to the courts. So the main figure, not the only figure, but the main figure we're going to talk about today, who was very much a Hamiltonian, was John Marshall. So give us a little bit of background about John Marshall, then we'll talk about some of his decisions.
Well, sure. I mean, John Marshall, of course, is from Virginia. So you would think, here's a guy from Virginia. He should be a good guy, right? It seems like all the Virginians in the antebellum period were all good guys. They all favored limited government, original constitution, but not John Marshall. And I think it would be fair to say that John Marshall and Hamilton were nationalists. I mean, that's the key here. And in fact, I don't know if you saw the interview with Bannon, where he started talking about nationalism the other day on 60 Minutes. But this is the entire point of the book. What you had was a nationalist coup of the general government. And John Marshall was just as much responsible for that as Alexander Hamilton. As you said, policies can come and go. But once you codify them in the Supreme Court and the federal court system, well, they're there. And there's not really much you can do about it unless some other court down the line comes in and says, well, that was the wrong interpretation. But Marshall was, like Hamilton, a person who was committed to the United States, not necessarily his state. You know, you can understand that with Hamilton. He's from Nevis, right? So he moves into the United States, and he doesn't really have a state as a home, but he eventually becomes a New Yorker. But Marshall's a guy that he came from prominent families in Virginia, was a cousin of Thomas Jefferson, and he becomes this nationalist who believes that there are Jacobins around every corner wanting to lop his head off. He calls the Jeffersonians terrorists, and this is a guy who wants to undo the entire Jeffersonian Revolution of 1800. I mean, that was his goal. So while he was in the general government, even before that point, you know, he was in the Adams administration, he was Secretary of State. And so just before Jefferson comes into office, the Congress will pass another Judiciary Act, which will allow Adams to appoint all these new federal judges. And just so happens that there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court, and John Marshall is appointed Chief Justice. And so that position for the next 35 years, John Marshall is going to do everything he can to codify Hamilton's nationalist dream. So if Hamilton was screwing up America, like I said, Marshall was doing his best to make sure it happened in perpetuity, right? So this guy is going to say that this nationalist vision that you had, and Hamilton couldn't have written Marshall's decisions better himself, which is the funny thing about it. You might as well just be Hamilton on the bench writing these opinions, because that's what it sounded like. And I think in so many ways, you know, this is why the original title of the book, and they just shortened it, was, you know, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America and Three Judges Who Helped. And this is one of the three. And I think just as bad as Hamilton in codifying this nationalist myth of American history.
You have a chapter in the book called Marshall versus Marshall. What do you mean by that?
Well, it was just like the Hamilton versus Hamilton. It's Marshall versus himself. So you have Marshall in June 1788 in the Virginia Ratifying Convention promising that, you know what, I know everyone's afraid of this new judicial branch, but don't worry, everybody. It's going to be fine. You're afraid that the state courts are going to be destroyed? No way. We can't do anything without the state courts. And guess what? We're never going to declare a state law unconstitutional. It's not going to happen. All your fears should be put aside, and you should go on about your business and ratify this Constitution because everything will be okay. And of course, once he becomes Supreme Court Chief Justice, he does the exact opposite, just like Hamilton did. I mean, Hamilton in 1788 was different than Hamilton in 1789 or Hamilton in 1787, you know, Hamilton versus Hamilton. So Marshall against himself, you have Marshall on one hand trying to argue for ratification, saying one thing, and Marshall once on the bench saying an entirely different thing. And I think that's the key to understanding this entire problem. We had a constitution that was sold to the states, fraudulently sold to the states like a lemon, and then we get this thing and everybody goes back on what they said they would do. And if we have time to talk about Joseph's story, I'll actually bring that up and how he flipped the entire ratification process on its head in that particular way as well. So that's Marshall lying essentially in 1788. And then you look at what Marshall said later, and it's the exact opposite.
I definitely want to make time to talk about Joseph's story. I think far fewer people know who he was than know Marshall and Hamilton. And we definitely got to talk about it because the Abel Upshur response to his work is so crushing. It's so crushing you almost feel sorry for Joseph's story, but then you remember nobody's ever heard of Abel Upshur. You think nobody's heard of Joseph's story. I mean, nobody heard of Abel
Upshur. That's right. All right. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. So, but we'll have that fun a little bit later. You've got several chapters now on the actual impact of Marshall and some of the major cases. So this is material you really need to know. If you're interested in American history and you want to know how America went down the path that it did, this is really a central piece of that puzzle. So let's start with the stuff on judicial review. Now, have you ever discussed this with Kevin Gutzman?
A little bit, not in detail.
Okay, because Kevin believes that there was a fundamental expectation of at least a very minimal or basic judicial review, that the Virginians, he said, basically kind of took this for granted. So he does not believe that per se was a radical innovation.
And I agree with him on that, to the extent that, I mean, I say in the book that there was some debate about this. I mean, basically, it came down to this. The states that had it already were fine with it. The states that didn't have it weren't fine with it.
Well, so, you know what? We should define what judicial review is, I just remembered.
Right. Judicial review being the idea that the federal court system can review legislation and decide whether it's constitutional or not. Does it fit with the Constitution? So now, again, the key, though, to all of this is just like I said with the Marshall versus Marshall. If you believe that judicial review was something that the founding generation considered, the ratifiers and the framers, and that maybe they wanted this, it was only in regard to federal law or laws the general government passed, not the state governments. So that was the key to all of this. I mean, they could maybe see that, all right, if the federal government passed a law that was unconstitutional, we want somebody to stop this thing. I mean, who's going to do that? So somebody has to be there refereeing this and saying, we're the backstop. We're going to say the umpire. We're going to say enough. This is unconstitutional. But that was it. They didn't want the states to become, you know, subservient to the general government. And I think that's one of the arguments that the Richmond Junto makes. It's a very powerful argument they make against this stuff later on. But, yeah, I mean, judicial review was generally contemplated, particularly in Virginia. It was talked about. And Patrick Henry said, well, I hope, I'm paraphrasing, that the federal judiciary will declare a law that's unconstitutional. So that was something that was, you know, we hear all the time that judicial review is completely unconstitutional. It's an implied power. Well, it is sort of. I mean, it doesn't spell out in the document you can do it, but the ratifiers said that, well, and generally that this might happen. So it's not necessarily unconstitutional according to the original Constitution as ratified, but there is nothing in the Constitution that says you can do this overall. Now, one thing I do say about it, just to kind of continue this out, Madison thought it should be limited, as you said, And he said, quote, it should be limited to cases of a judiciary nature. And that meant that it wasn't open to expounding the Constitution. And so he didn't want the bench, the federal bench, to the Supreme Court to say, okay, well, this is what we think how the law should be interpreted and meant. It was just basically to law and fact, not interpretation of the law or the Constitution. That's that limited judicial review you're talking about.
I want to talk about some of the, maybe you can give us a couple examples of famous cases from the Marshall era. And I think the reason a lot of people who call themselves conservatives have been pro-Marshall is that Marshall seems to come out on the side of contracts and property.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not so concerned about the procedural aspects, that maybe he's overstepping his bounds and maybe he's extending the authority of the federal courts too much. But what they like is he seems to be a conservative, stodgy old man of property, and he's against the mob. And that's the way the Federalists have been portrayed against the Jeffersonians.
Mm-hmm.
It's the good, respectable people against the stupid, ignorant mob. And so that's why conservatives have gone for Marshall. So what's wrong with thinking that way?
Well, I think the problem is, of course, that he's going beyond, again, what they intended the federal court system to do. And that's where you start running into the states. And so, for example, you know, in Fletcher v. Peck, right, it's one of the more famous cases of the Marshall Court. And we can talk about a couple of others that I think are pretty fun. But Fletcher v. Peck had to do with this immense fraud in Georgia. You had something called the Yazoo land scandal, right? So this legislature of Georgia sold all of this land to the West, and they sold it because they were bribed. These Northerners came in, said, look, if you do this, we'll essentially pay you to sell us this land. And so they did it. They sold all the land to the speculation company. And the people of Georgia were ticked about it. So they booted the entire legislature out, elected a new governor, and that new legislature and new governor voided the deal. So, of course, it goes to court. And Marshall sides against rules against Georgia. He says, look, you got the contract clause of the Constitution. You can't do this. You can't just void a contract. I mean, these people had a valid contract. It didn't matter this was fraudulently done. None of that mattered. All that matters is was a contract. And so we have to abide by the contract. And you know what? I don't really care if you try to cite the 11th Amendment here. For those of you who don't know, the 11th Amendment allowed for state sovereign immunity, meaning the states could say we're not going to be sued in court because this didn't involve a state. So Marshall said, it doesn't involve a state. You can't decide you're not going to be sued here. And I'm going to say that your decision to invalidate these contracts violates Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution because the states can't do that. So this is a massive coup because essentially what he's doing is saying, you know what, the states, you're subservient to us. We tell you what you can and can't do. And this is, as I say in the book, this is really Hamilton coming from the grave again, because Hamilton had actually said something about this very case in 1795 when they were talking about the Yazoo. And this case was 1810 that it made it before the Supreme Court, but this thing was hanging out there for years. And so Hamilton said that essentially at that point, look, if we take the Constitution in its large sense, then we can go ahead and do this. Essentially, this is an implied power that we can go in and say you violated the contract clause. We'll just say you did it. It doesn't really matter if this is really what we meant by obligation of contracts or not. We'll just take it as an implied power and say you violated the Constitution, and so be it. You're done. So this is very dangerous because as you move forward, the states really can't block anything that the general government does because ultimately, the Supreme Court will just come in and say, you can't do that. We're gonna invalidate your laws. I think the most interesting case in this particular situation was Cohens v. Virginia, which nobody knows anything about. I mean, this is one of those cases that you said, name some landmark cases. This one's not going to come up ever because it's such a case that really shows what this Marshall Court wanted to do. And it's destructive for the state. So what happened was you had two brothers from Maryland selling lottery tickets that were issued by the general government in Virginia. Now, there's several things going on here. One, these guys are from Maryland. They're selling lottery tickets in Virginia where it's illegal. And these lottery tickets are from the general government, not a state. So there's so many things going on here. So these guys are arrested and fined for this. And Virginia had done something very interesting. They had said, okay, the problem with the Judiciary Act, and it was Section 25 of the Judiciary Act, is that you can appeal a state decision to federal court. That's really what was happening here. So if I go through the state court process and I don't like what happened, I can just appeal to the federal court system now and try to find some relief. And what the state of Virginia says is, okay, certain courts, you can't appeal it to the Court of Appeals in Virginia. So it basically stops at that level, meaning you can't go through the entire court process because we're going to say you can't do that anymore. So what these guys did, they were found guilty and fined, but it couldn't go any further in Virginia. So they just appealed right to the federal court system, which was completely beyond the scope of the Judiciary Act. You weren't supposed to be able to do that. So what happens is that Marshall actually sides with Virginia. And he says, look, you're right. These guys were breaking the law. But at the same time, he lectures the states and said, you cannot essentially work against the general government here. And he dusts off this idea that one people ratified the Constitution, only the people in their entirety can unmake the Constitution. Virginia had to appear in court. This 11th Amendment doesn't apply again. So what he's doing is essentially invoking the Supremacy Clause, which is not the original interpretation of that, if you look at how it was argued in the ratifying process, and saying that this state has to abide by a federal court decision. Now, there were people in Virginia that went nuts over this. I mean, because he basically said now the state courts are subservient to the federal courts, and not that the state courts were co-equal courts. Now one is subservient to the other. And this basically knocked down any of the ability of any state or any state court to go out and block federal legislation. And so that was the real danger of a law, of a decision like that. Same thing with Fletcher B. Peck. And there was others, there was Martin versus Hunter's Lessee in 1816, which did the exact same thing. So this was one of the points that Marshall was trying to make: federal supremacy, and not just that, federal judiciary supremacy. The state courts become the agents of the federal courts, and so you have to just do whatever the federal court system wants. And I think that's the real danger of John Marshall.
Well, a related danger is his codification of the idea of implied powers that we get out of Hamilton.
Right.
So talk about how we get from Hamilton to Marshall. Like, where does the idea of implied powers enter the legal understanding, the understanding of lawyers when they look at the Constitution?
Right. So we go back to implied powers. I mean, this idea that, well, you don't have to find it in the Constitution. It's just there if we say it's there. Right? I mean, you can read between the lines and you can find this power. And of course, Hamilton famously, foisted this position upon the American public in his argument for a Bank of the United States in 1791. He said, I understand that, that Jefferson's right, Washington, when they were arguing back and forth, that there's no specific power in the Constitution that allows us to charter a bank. But you know what? It's necessary and proper for me to do my job. And so I need to do that. And so Washington eventually sided with Hamilton. Of course, the bank becomes law and it expires. And so in 1816, we get another Bank of the United States. This time, James Madison, the guy who was arguing against it in 1791, now says, oh yeah, the bank's constitutional. I mean, it's one of these crazy twists in American history. But not everyone's sold. And so eventually we have a panic. We have an economic depression in 1819, and the second Bank of the United States is blamed for it. And at one point, Maryland, the state of Maryland, was trying to tax the bank. Now, they were not doing it to tax it out of existence, it's often thought. What they want to do is just siphon some profits. They were having some financial problems, the state was. So we'll just siphon some profits off of this bank here. I mean, it's making all this money, and we'll use it ourselves. Well, the president of that bank, his name was McCulloch, he refuses to pay the tax, and so it goes to court. Now, this was probably, in my opinion, the most important case in the entire 19th century. And now you can make a case that there's some others that are pretty important as well. But this one, because what it does is it takes Hamilton's argument for implied powers that he made in 1791, and it codifies it and makes it part of our federal record now through the federal court system. because this McCulloch v. Maryland decision in 1819, everyone knew what it was going to do. Marshall himself knew what it was going to do, which is why he was leaking the case to the defense team. And saying, you know, this is going to be it. They were allowed three attorneys instead of just two. And everyone was on pins and needles waiting for Marshall's decision. And the funny thing was, Daniel Webster argued for the fact that, you know, the United States, the Bank of the United States could not be taxed. He was arguing for this implied power position. And he basically was just regurgitating Hamilton. And then when Marshall makes his decision, what does he do? He regurgitates Daniel Webster, who regurgitates Alexander Hamilton. I mean, this was the point. They were just going to make sure that this idea that we can do anything we want to do, that implied powers are legal, we're going to make sure that becomes the standard interpretation of the Constitution through this McCulloch v. Maryland decision. And it's had a long-lasting effect. I mean, now the Congress, people in Congress can stand up and say, well, it's constitutional because we say it is. You know, Obamacare is constitutional because we say it is. How dare you challenge us, citizen? Congress has spoken. I'm sure the federal courts will agree, and they eventually did. So, I mean, where's the check on federal power? They can just do anything they want. And this was the point of no return here in 1819. And again, that Richmond Junto, people like Thomas Ritchie and others, I mean, they knew it. John Taylor of Caroline, some of these names who have been completely forgotten. They knew what was happening here, and they tried to stand up and say, this is very dangerous, that we're going to destroy the states. You know, Spencer Roane, another guy that nobody knows anything about. These people were worried that this decision was going to destroy the states, reduce them to mere corporations of the general government, which is what happened. This is what Hamilton said he wanted to do in 1787, and it's essentially what happened. States can't sneeze without the general government saying it's okay now. And if you try to block a federal legislation, I mean, well, you can't say that because we say it's constitutional. So it opened a Pandora's box that's never been closed.
All right, let's shift gears and talk about our favorite guy, Joseph Story, who really popularizes a lot of the ideas we've just been talking about. Talk about, first of all, who is Joseph Story and why? What did he do that made these ideas so influential?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, Joseph Story was appointed by James Madison. And you mentioned Kevin Gutzman earlier. Kevin has said that this is probably the worst appointment in terms of, you know, you're in lining with the president's philosophy in the history of the Supreme Court. So Madison appoints Story thinking, I've got this good Republican. I'm going to appoint him on there. He's going to do a good job. He's going to have a limited idea on the. And he does the exact opposite. Now, he was a very young man when he was appointed. And it's believed, now Joseph Story's son says, no, this isn't the case. But it's believed that, of course, John Marshall got his hooks into him, and Story became just as much of a nationalist as John Marshall. In fact, he became Marshall's right-hand man. Now, that alone would make Story a bad guy in terms of, you know, that he was part of all these terrible decisions. But he became a law professor, and he wrote a three-volume book entitled Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States. So now this guy can influence future judges, lawyers, for centuries. I mean, people still read this Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States along with the Federalist Essays, and they think, wow, I've just understood the Constitution. And of course, it's a complete myth. It's the nationalist myth in American history, but this is why Story is so long-lasting, because he still has currency. People still read his book. He was influencing judges. If you take a constitutional law class in law school, I can almost guarantee you're going to talk about Joseph Story, or at least these decisions. And so what do you expect from this book? It defends everything Marshall did. It defends the nationalist interpretation of the Constitution. And it's a complete farce. But that's why, you know, Story is so dangerous. And you have conservatives, again, standing up and saying Joseph Story was an originalist. And what, I don't know what world they're living in, but if you go back and look at the ratification debates, he's no way an originalist. I mean, this guy was going back on everything that was argued during the ratification of the Constitution. It's embarrassing, really, when they say that, but that's what happens.
We should say something, because I tantalized people earlier on about Abel Upshur and his he has a short book called Our Federal Government, Its True Nature and Character, which is a response to the Story commentaries, and it is just crushing. Every major point is just taken apart mercilessly. It's beautifully done. I've got a copy around here somewhere, but it makes excellent reading all these years later. I mean, 170, 180 years later, I guess.
Right. It's wonderful. And of course, Upshur is, again, one of these Virginians that nobody knows anything about. So you said, you know, nobody knows anything about Joseph Story. Even fewer people know anything about Abel Upshur or John Taylor of Caroline, who were both essentially, you know, Upshur's book was in direct response to the commentaries. Taylor was writing before the commentaries came out. But still, one thing that Story does, and then I'll get into Upshur, that's so wrong. You know, when you look at the arguments for the Constitution, what Story does is he actually takes the anti-federalists, the opponents, and he says, you know what? The opponents of the Constitution said we would have a national government. The opponents of the Constitution said we would have a very powerful presidency, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what we have. So they were right.
Right.
It's the strangest argument you'd ever see. I mean, these people were, they're right. They told us exactly what we have. Isn't that great? It's crazy. But then you have Upshur, who attacks Story as this one people. One of the things that the nationalists always said, Marshall included, and he said this in McCulloch v. Maryland, was that, you know, I understand people say that the states ratify the Constitution. Well, that's simply not true in that how else were the people going to ratify it except in the states? So one people did ratify it, but they had to do state conventions because that was the only way it would work. So we have one people, as the preamble says, who ratified the Constitution, not the states. And that one people gave us the American nation, this national government that has all the power. The Supremacy Clause says so. What are you dunderheads out there saying that it doesn't say so? So Upshur goes in and says, no, this is stupid. That's not true. And he goes back to the colonial period and he says there was no – another thing that people said is that the Union predated the states. He said this isn't true at all. There was no common government, no common treasury. The British government dealt with each state individually when they finally gained their independence. And each state was recognized separately in the peace treaty of 1783. Congress had no legislative powers. Its acts were resolutions, not laws. And that's an important distinction to make. Congress could pass resolutions under the Articles of Confederation, but they had no teeth. So the states could just say, we're not going to do that. And they didn't have to. It's just like the United Nations. No one would say that the United Nations passes laws. They pass resolutions. And the separate countries can say, we're going to do that or not. We're not going to agree to your stupid treaty or whatever it is. We're just not going to agree to that. So we're not going to do it. It's a resolution. Upshur was pointing that out. He was also attacking the American system of Henry Clay. He supported nullification. I mean, this book, as you said, it's beautiful when you read it, and it's short. And the cool thing about it, this book was actually republished in the 1860s in the North during the war as proof of the Southern position. And so its currency goes beyond just the simple, you know, refutation of Joseph's story. It attacks the very nature of the nationalist argument, and it's so good and so meaty and such a short little book, you almost just can't believe it. I mean, you're reading it and saying, my gosh, this is right. And you think everybody should read this thing. And then, of course, you realize nobody has read this thing. You get depressed about it. But hopefully more people will now.
In the 20th century, maybe the best book on this that I can think of might have been by James Kilpatrick, that book, The Sovereign States, which right. May be where I first learned about Upshur in the first place. And I think sometimes we're inclined to think that a 19th century book will be too hard to read, or maybe it won't be all that helpful. But wow, is the Upshur book a rebuke to that way of thinking, because it is such a tremendous book and so well done. Now, there's more to talk about in your book, certainly, but as we bring our conversation to a close today, people get this information, what do they do with it? Do they just lament that it turned out this way? I mean, I know, look, I don't think there's a whole lot we can do about the situation that we're in, but how do you close the book? How do you finish a book like this?
Well, the last chapter is entitled Think Locally, Act Locally, which is what I say on my podcast all the time. And so what we have to start doing is changing our perspective. One thing I would hope would come out of this is, I know there are lawyers that listen to your podcast. They listen to mine. There are people that are in law school that listen to both. And I would hope that these people would come out and they would practice, and maybe they're going to become judges one day, and they can start trying to use the court system and undo all this nonsense. I mean, that can happen. It's going to be a slow process, but that could happen. But also, I think what we have to start doing is looking within our local communities. First, start with your home. I mean, this is, how can you take the people in your home and get them to not believe this nationalist nonsense. I mean, and if everybody did that, if everybody started thinking, you know, I don't really care what happens in California if I live in Florida or Alabama. I really care what happens in Florida or Alabama. Well, then that would change a lot. I mean, why does it matter if California goes completely insane and passes a whole bunch of stupid legislation? I don't live there. And if the people in California don't like it, they can move. They can move to Texas. They can move to some other state. They can get out of there. It's not our job to really worry about what's happening in California. I want to make sure my state, my local community does whatever it and follows the line of thinking in terms of government and society that I like. And so if you do that, you can basically undermine all of this stuff without even having to go through the federal government. And as more and more people are aware, you know, of the states and the powers of the states and originalism, I mean, look, I know you've been around this as long as I have. And so, you know, 20 years ago, nobody would have been talking about Abel Upshur in a book that a major publisher has just put out. I know you did this with Nullification, and of course I'm doing it here. But this would have been impossible because you mentioned Kilpatrick. That was the 1950s. And of course, that thing has been panned because it was written during the civil rights era. We're not talking about any type of issue here that has to do with something so unsavory as the civil rights era. This is about just the power of government. What can government do and not do? And you can apply this to all kinds of different things. So you've got the 10th Amendment Center now. All of this stuff wasn't possible just 20 years ago. And so much has changed in that time. And it actually makes me optimistic because I think that as people start thinking locally and acting locally and say, you know, I'm just going to go out and take care of my backyard here. I'm going to worry about the people around me and my local government and my state. And I could just give a flip about the general government. You're going to see it loses its power. The emperor has no clothes anymore. And so that is the great fear, I think, among nationalists, is that if people just stop caring, what does it matter anymore? How is that government going to work and deal with that? And it's a nullification through lack of consent and lack of interest. And then you have a situation where now you've changed the entire paradigm of American history. Now it's the bottom up rather than the top down. And I think that works.
Well, the book is How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. I'm going to be linking to it at tomwoods.com/1003. Brian, do you still have, are you still using that dedicated page for it?
Yes, it'll actually just, it'll go to my homepage now, but it doesn't go to the contest anymore. That's over. So sorry, I know a lot of people did get in on that, but it doesn't go to that anymore. So it goes to my BrianMcClanahan.com. Just read Rex there.
Okay, because that was BlameHamilton.com,
right,
which was a great idea, way to generate pre-release sales. We talked about it the last time you were here. So TomWoods.com/1003 will have a link to this book, which you should pick up, and you will be learning the history that they didn't teach you. And of course, Brian, we've got coming up in the next couple of weeks a course on Alexander Hamilton for Liberty Classroom that you did, which is a great companion to this book. So great. What can I ask you, have you thought about what your next project is, or are you just glad this one's over and can't think that far ahead?
I'm just glad this one's over at this point.
Yeah.
with the advance, you know, the pre-release and giveaways and all that kind of stuff, it's been like I've been working on Hamilton for months now. And so I kind of want to put this behind me, and then I'll think of something else to do. It's just, and of course, the podcast and everything else that I'm doing. So there's still a lot going on. It's just I don't have another project on tap right now.
And so I do want to mention also, you keep mentioning the podcast, the Brian McClanahan Show has a whole bunch of episodes. What number are you up to now?
Oh, I'm up to 113 or 114. I can't remember right off the top of my head which one we're at when this airs. So it's something like that. But we're over 100.
All right. Well, that is really impressive. So I'm going to also link to the Brian McClanahan Show at tomwoods.com/1003, which you should definitely check out. And we'll leave it there. Brian, thanks so much and best of luck with the book.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking to Chris Guillebeau, New York Times bestselling author, who returns to the show for a third time to talk about his brand new book that's being released tomorrow called Side Hustle, From Idea to Income in 27 Days. Then the day after that, so that'll be episode 1005, I'm going to talk to Jeff Herbner about the general subject, Is It True That are, you know, our kids going to be worse off than we are? And are we correctly measuring income? And are we correctly measuring improvements in people's standard of living? Can government statistics capture this correctly? So we're going to get into that sort of topic. Then Dave Smith returns to the show. So we're going to talk about a lot of current event stuff. But he has got the number one comedy album on iTunes. That is Libertas by Dave Smith. Very, very exciting for him. So glad he's going to be a special guest on the Contra Cruise this year. And then finally, we will be talking once again to Professor Jared Casey, who has an enormous new book, a brand new history of political thought, but more or less from a libertarian perspective. So all the major thinkers are covered and critiqued from a libertarian perspective. Absolutely fantastic. It's a thrill to talk to him. I played you an excerpt or a little interview I did with him last week, just to get you ready and salivating for the great, great interview that's coming up later this week. So much fun stuff. If you're enjoying the show, consider joining me as a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com. You get access to the private Facebook group, which is worth its weight in gold, but also many, many other benefits, like so many that if I ever come to my senses someday, I'll probably have to reduce them. So check that out at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.